Welcome to the West Highland Way Race podcast. I'm John Kinniston, and this is episode 13.
Go from A to the B, cross an ocean, cross a sea, cause I think I like you, I think I do. You can't deny, I deserve it if you try, cause I think I like you.
In this week's episode, we've got a few items. First of all, I'll read out my favourite blog post of the week, and this time it's Fiona Rennie's blog. So that will start. That's about 6 minutes or so. And then Ian Duggan interviewed Mike Raffan. And so that's the next item on the podcast, which is interview lasts about 12 minutes or so. And Ian has asked Mike some various questions. And so hopefully that will be an interesting listen as well. And then the next item is myself, actually. I had an email from Ian Wallace asking me a few questions about how I coped with DOMS, with muscle soreness, quad soreness, from the first year to the second year. And he asked a few questions, and I thought, well, probably be worth answering those on a podcast. It went on a little bit longer than I'd planned. That's about 30 minutes, mainly because I read out a few articles as well. But I think that hopefully will be an interesting aspect, because I know a lot of us struggle with sore quads. And then the final part is my lessons in the West Highland Way, number 11. I did this a few weeks ago, but there wasn't really space in the podcast over the last few weeks. So I've put that one in at the end there. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. And I say start with favourite blog post, then Mike Raffan, then myself on DOMS, and then I'll finish off with lesson number 11. My favourite blog post of the week comes from Fiona Rennie, and her blog site is Fiona Rennie, whw.blogspot.co.uk. Fiona's ran the race 8 times, this year will be her 9th time, and so she has a lot of experience and a lot of thoughts about how to train and how to prepare. And the blog post I'm going to read out is from Thursday the 5th of April 2012, and it's entitled Training and Thoughts for This Year's West Highland Way. January the 1st is the date I usually start to focus and train for the West Highland Way, but this year has been a wee bit different. Clearing Mum's house was a tough job, and all my running was without real purpose other than comfort, and I managed to clock up 155 miles for the month, with my longest run being just short of 16 miles, going from Balmerhaugh to Rowadennan and back. The weekend, hordes of West Highland Way family were there doing various distances. It was good to be there, enjoying the route, the company, and the camaraderie in the pub afterwards. This was the weekend we should have been celebrating Mum's birthday. February started with a cracking comfort run from Crianlarich to Doonbothy and back. My monthly mileage was 198 miles. Again, nothing with big, but with some quality tempos giving it big wellies. The club organised a new race, the Villa 15K, on the 26th. I usually just help out at Carnegie races, but I thought I'd have a run at this one, especially as there was a bottle of Scallion for doing it. So after sitting at registration, handing out numbers until 10 minutes before the start, I just had time to nip to the loo before heading to the start line. Not what you'd call a warm-up, but since I was only here for the beer, that was fine. I worked quite hard once I got into my stride, really enjoying my first race of the year and my beer. March the 3rd saw me on the start line for the Smokies 10, a ladies-only 10-miler in its 24th year, and for the first time in a couple of years, I stood there without nursing injuries or illness, so the race plan was to go out hard and hang on. Not technically the best race plan, but one in the TTFU, don't let go category. I ran my third best for the race. I was well pleased, considering this is around my 19th or 20th time of running this race. On Sunday the 11th, Ken dropped Sue and I at Derry Darrock. He was Munro bagging with his friend and would meet us later at Bridge of Orkey. We had a lovely 19 miles to Murdo's Mount, then back down to Bridge of Orkey. Photos perfectly timed to meet Ken, We had the best of the weather, the cloud was low, and Ken and Paul only saw mist and rain. The following week, Pauline and I did just over 22 miles, going from Balmahar to near the beech tree and back. She groaned when I whipped up my camera within 5 minutes of heading up Connick Hill. "Are you here for a training run or a picnic?" I answered, "I've bought food." She did relax a bit later to say, I think I feel a photy coming on, which were in the remnants of Karadabad Forest. There's lots of photos on Fiona's blog that you may want to have a look at. Although I hadn't done any big runs, I wasn't worried. My training had been consistent, knocking out a weekly mileage of between 50 and 60 miles, feeling healthy and strong. Last week, I unexpectedly went over 70 miles on the 27th. I did surprise myself with a 32-mile run from Milngavie up past Karadabad Forest and back purely because it was a lovely warm day. I only planned to run about marathon distance. I dropped Erin and her pal at the SECC at around lunchtime and didn't need to be back until the back of 10, so I was happy to use as much of the day as possible. I did need my head torch going back through Mug Dog Park, not so much to see my footing, but to make sure I was heading the right way. I can do Mug Dog in the dark, but heading the wrong direction, it looked quite different. I had a brilliant day out on Sunday with a group run organised by Mike Raffin, an 18-miler up Loch Nagar. It was a bonus to find out we did 5 Munros and a couple of Corbett's thrown in for good measure. Placing a stone on the weekend in tribute to Dario was something I've wanted to do for a long time, and there was a fair selection of miniatures and hip flasks raised in his name. Again, lots of photos on the blog. I remember a few years ago, Chris Robinson, Scottish endurance coach and Scottish representative in the 10,000 metres in the 1994 Commonwealth Games, once said, "A farmer doesn't dig up his tatties to see how well they're growing." And with that analogy, I don't feel the need to run myself into the ground during training. With 8 West Highland Way races and 4 24-hour races, I think I kind of know how to run tired and sore, and I don't have to practice it too often. Except I'll be doing the Highland Fling, but at West Highland Way race pace until I come off the roller coaster, then I'll push on to the finish. So for this year's race, I don't know if I'll be running close to a PB of around 26 hours, or if I'll have bonus challenges that will slow me down to 34 hours 59 minutes. But whatever happens, I'll be doing the best I can, and without a doubt, I'll bash the leisure centre doors off their hinges again with a big daft grin on my face. And Fiona's put a few photos of some of the finishing photos of her in the West Highland Way. So again, if you want to look at the photos particularly and read any more from Fiona, her address is fionarennie@whw.blogspot.co.uk, or you can go to the West Highland Way Race website, westhighlandwayrace.org.uk, and then you can click on the link to the West Highland Way blog updates from there. So thanks for that post, Fiona, and I hope you continue to enjoy your training as you prepare for your 9th West Highland Way race. What's the difference between me and you?
My name's Ian Duggan. I'm here with Mike Raffin, who I'll be doing some support crew for this year in the West Highland Way race, doing a little interview for the West Highland Way podcast. Mike, tell us how you got involved in the West Highland Way race in the first place.
I was involved with supporting George Reed and Keith Hughes 2 years ago. They were doing a crazy double from Fort William down to Mulgai and then back again. And I ran about 50 miles of it, which is probably more than most support runners do.
Certainly a lot more than I'll be doing anyway. What's your main memories of that race? What sort of stuck with you, and what made you want to do it yourself, I guess?
The main memory, I'm not sure if this convinced me to do it, was at Ochtertyre Farm, the bridge about half a mile before, seeing Keith getting into the water and his body was starting to convulse, and I didn't know what the hell was going on with him. So I'm not sure how that convinced me to do the race.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like the most appealing thing in the world. No, definitely not. So how many times have you done the race? Last year was your first one, is that right?
Yeah, first one in 2011, and going back for another this year.
Another shot, as it were, yes. What made you want to come back for the second year? Not people convulsing in rivers, presumably.
I did the race last year, and I was very happy with the time, but within a couple of hours of finishing, I knew I'd come back because I knew I could do better.
What was your time last year?
It was 21 and a half hours and 4 seconds.
So what do you think you learned from the first year? I mean, what makes you think you can come back and do better?
I guess there was just points during the race that, I don't know, it was just little things like knowing to tell my support team to do certain things, fill my water up before I got there, maybe having 2 supplies of water so I've got one on me and then I can just swap that over when I get to the checkpoint. That sort of thing.
And yeah, you had quite a bad section as well, didn't you? That was quite a lot slower than the rest that affected your time quite badly.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. It was just came out of Tindrum, going to Bridge of Orkey. I was just like my worst low point of the race. I mean, going through 95 miles, you're going to hit low points and you're going to hit high points. But it was just going over Tindrum and Bridge of Orkey. I was more or less walking the section and couldn't pick it up.
So what sort of training are you doing for the Westland Way this year? Similar to last year, have you made some changes, or is it just lots and lots of running, basically?
I've increased my mileage from last year. Over Christmas, I started with a Markathon in December, but being an ultra runner, I thought, Markathon's not enough. I would do double Markathon.
Too easy.
And not just double mileage, double time, so I did it December and January and a bit of February. I deliberately stopped myself after 75 days of continuous running, averaging 10.3 miles a day, because I was getting to the point where I was running for the sake of doing it every day rather than running because I was enjoying it. And that's given me a good base training to build on. And now I run probably 6 days a week. During the week I'm doing 10 miles a day, 2 speed sessions a week. At the weekend, I'm doing a longer run, maybe 20 to 30 miles.
So what's your weekly mileage look like, roughly?
Somewhere between 50 and 70 miles a week.
Are you ramping that up towards the Westland Way race, or is it pretty constant?
It's pretty constant. 1 week, when we had the West Highland Way training weekend, that was 121 miles that week. That's the most I've ever done, and I doubt I'll get anywhere near that again.
So you don't follow an exact training plan. It's reasonably loose.
Yeah, I don't find that exact training plans suit me, but I think the main thing is regular running. When I first trained for my first marathon, I had a training plan, but I couldn't stick to it due to various things. But what I've learnt since then was the sort of regular training is what counts rather than sticking exactly to your plan.
Getting time on your feet constantly. So how's your backup team going to be organised for this year?
Well, I've got Annette from my crew last year, my fiancée. She's in control. She's the person that will be sorting everything out. All I have to do is run. She'll sort everything else out. And I've got yourself and your good lady wife who will be joining the net for the, well, you'll be doing it for the whole race. And then I've got a couple other guys who think they're going to get to run near the, last year they got to run for the last 15 miles, but my intention this year is that they won't have the opportunity because I'll be too close to the leaders.
Which is what, within 4 hours going into the last checkpoint, is that right?
I think you're allowed from Bridge of Orkey if you're not within 4 hours, but I intend to be within 4 hours.
Have you got any advice for support crews? You know, having done the run once, anything you'd pass on to people doing support? Like, you know, always be outside when your runner's going past?
Yeah, last year I went through Glencoe and I went to a car park and there was an empty car that was locked and my support crew was nowhere to be seen. They were sitting in the cafe having a cup of tea. I basically dropped my water bottle on top of the car, asked somebody else's support crew to go and get them, and told them I would meet them at the bottom of the Devil's Staircase.
There probably is advice there, actually, that from the runner point of view, that you didn't get too worked up, you didn't get pissed off, you didn't lose your shirt, you just kept going.
Yeah, it's, you got to learn that they're giving up their weekend to look after you. There's no point in getting angry with them, because A, it's going to make the rest of the race bad in terms of going into a checkpoint and being angry with them, but you're wasting your energy. You can take that out in the pub once you get finished the race.
Right, ignore the pub at the end. Gotcha, no problems. So what kind of reactions are you getting from friends when you tell them you do 95 mile runs? Friends and strangers, I suppose, actually, because it does come up in conversation quite a lot.
Friends, they know what I'm doing every weekend, going out in the hills and run that. So they might not believe me, but they know what I'm doing. Strangers are, they don't believe it's true. Nobody can run 95 miles. It's not possible.
I mean, it is quite a good question, I suppose. What drives you to do 95 mile runs? I mean, you've been doing ultras for, this is your third season doing ultras, is that right?
Yeah, I've done various different distances. I started off at 10k, half marathon, marathon, 33, 55, and I feel probably most comfortable anything between about 50 and 100 milers.
Mm-hmm. So it's a comfortable distance for most people, yeah, definitely. It's good stuff. So is it just a natural, you know, just pushing your boundaries, seeing how far you can go, seeing how fast you can go, for how long?
Yeah, I think so.
Plus the insanity, you know, the crippling insanity.
Yeah.
But how do you keep your motivation up to train for that kind of thing? I mean, you know, you're saying you're doing 50 plus miles a week, takes up a lot of time. What keeps you going through the training, through the winter especially?
Well, I've got a colleague at work, Dave Morrow. He's an ultra runner as well, and we both train at lunchtimes, and having somebody there to train with doing the same sort of distances, it helps you get out and do it. But really, I started running four years ago and nobody's told me to stop yet. So
quick fire questions about your preferences for the West Isle Away race. Road or trail shoes?
A lot of people use road shoes, but I definitely prefer trail shoes, or possibly even sort of more barefoot shoe.
You going to change shoes halfway through or anything? You going to switch pairs when your feet start getting a bit swollen?
Last year I had Rocklite 315s and they were fine the whole way through. I had no reason to change them. I changed my socks but not my shoes. And I kind of regretted doing that because it wasted a couple of minutes and my feet were wet again within a few miles.
Yeah, you're not going to get through that with dry feet, are you? What's your favourite foods to keep you going?
Last year it was blueberries. You get a spike in energy from them. Butteries, most people won't know that if they're not from Aberdeen. You might know them as rowies.
Just they're sort of fat and salt,
basically. Fat and salt, yeah. Pastry. Yeah.
Butteries.
And the other thing was a milkshake with, it's like a sports milkshake, so it's got added whey and basically milk with milk powder and added milk and some more milk. And a bit of energy in it.
That's nice. Milk didn't upset your stomach when you're running?
No, a lot of people find that they can't take milk when they're running, but it works fine for me, and I think that's the key thing, just finding what works for you.
Yeah, definitely. Hydration pack or water bottle?
It's a difficult one. Last year it was a hydration pack, but since then I've been running with a water bottle. But it's possibly because it's been colder weather. I don't know. I think having the opportunity to have both.
What are you going to have in there, water or energy drink?
Water all the way. A wise man, George Reed, once told me that when did it become hydration and nutrition? It's food and drink, and you keep them separate.
Good advice. Sound advice. Do you take salt tablets at all?
I do. But I'm not sure that they do much. But I think it's more a psychological thing rather than anything else.
Yeah, there's some discussion over how much salt the body can actually absorb off running and things, isn't there? So yeah. Do you run with a watch or a Garmin?
A Garmin, every time. Unless I've left the Garmin at home, every day that I'm out running, I've got my Garmin on me. I can go back for the last 4 years and tell you exactly where I was on what date.
What's your favourite section of the race?
last year was I commenced down Glen Nevis. I'd had my three support runners at that point, Al, Tommy and Mrs. Shanksy, and Tommy was feeding me jelly babies every 5 minutes, and I was on a high shouting at myself, just random rubbish just to keep me motivated. And at one point Vicky couldn't keep up with me, and knowing that your support runner who's fresh can't keep up with you when you're running down there was just fantastic.
Yeah, you're dropping your support runners, you're probably doing something right there. Yeah. You got a favourite mantra you use to keep going, speaking of shouting at yourself?
Yeah, one thing that I wrote in my hand so that I can look at it any time. If you're going too fast or you're going too slow, you think things are getting too hard, the thing I wrote in my hand was, don't be a dick.
Works in most occasions, I would think. Should get a t-shirt printed with that on ours. Team, don't be a dick. We could all wear them. That could definitely work. What do you listen to when you're doing the race? Anything?
You don't need to. The West Highland Way has got such fantastic scenery. If you're that bored that you have to listen to music, then you probably shouldn't be doing the race.
Harsh words. What do you look forward to most once you've finished, other than, you know, being finished, I guess?
Last year I had a bottle of Hardcore IPA sitting at the finish line, and it went down really nicely.
What's your final tip for other West Highland Way runners?
I'm sure everybody will find their own thing during the race, but one thing that I found, it was at Vicky Bridge, and I remember to pack a toothbrush, and after eating rubbish for the last 60-70 miles, brushing your teeth feels fantastic, and it really lifts you again.
Excellent. Mr. Mike Raffin, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Raffin.
On these podcasts, I've asked a few times if anyone's got any comments or questions that they would like or to answered, or areas that we'd like to cover. And I received a really nice email from Ian Wallace this week. This is what Ian wrote and asked me to think about. Hi, John. I hope you don't mind me contacting you again. I've just been listening to West Highland Way podcast number 10. I can't tell you how much of an invaluable resource these recordings are, especially for me as a first timer. So thanks again for all the time you spend on these. The inspiration night was excellent too. I was the one who asked the first question about salt tablets. I'd heard quite a few folk on the forum talk about taking Succeed, so it was interesting to hear the medical guys saying that there was absolutely no need to do this. I wanted to ask a couple of things about your account of your own West Highland Way races. I was very interested in your different experience with sore quads late in the race. Going backwards down the Devil's Staircase does not sound like fun. I am a bit scared of this. In last year's fling, I had run pretty hard off Connick Hill and felt fine up to Benglass. But after sitting down there for too long, my quads cramped up and I couldn't then run down the hills through the forest to Aug de Tir. At the time, I put it down to cramps because of the hot weather. But now I'm wondering if it was just lack of conditioning. You said that William Sitchell had sent you an article about DOMS that could be worth sharing on the forum Facebook. I'd certainly like to read it. Do you put your success to 2008 down to just running more downhills in training that year? How hard do you run these in training? Do you have specific sessions that you do? Do you think it is wise to run hard off Connick early on or take it easy? I'd be very interested in hearing a lot more about this. Perhaps a good subject for another interview podcast. Thanks very much, John. All the best, Ian. Ian did have another question about kit as well, but I'll probably answer that one privately. But it made me think that maybe this would be worth doing on a podcast and sharing a few thoughts about what happened. I think for me, after that 2007 race, when my quads were so sore and I did have to walk backwards coming off the Devil's Staircase, it made me really determined to think more about this and to see how I could improve my that soreness in my quads. Because I realised for me that was going to be a massive factor. If I wanted to run any faster, then I had to improve that. And for the whole winter of leading up to the 2008 race, my whole mantra, my whole thinking was that I wanted to get to King's House with enough left to still be able to run, which is what I couldn't do in 2007. And so I started looking into this a little bit more, and I think I put something on the blog. And I remember reading, I saw an article about William Sitchell, and I hadn't met William at that point. And this article was all about his running and his ultra running particularly, and the distance he did and various things. But there was one little bit in the article where he said in his very first race, he really suffered from sore quads and he just couldn't run at all. And they were just so painful. And he talked about DOMS, which I had never heard before, delayed onset of muscle soreness. And he said that he'd read this article and written by his coach, and it had made such a difference to him, and he'd done various things, and he'd never had a problem with DOMS again. So I remember I found his email, or I got in touch with his contacting him, wrote to him, and he was brilliant, and we've been friends since. And he got back to me, and then I must have put that on my blog as well. And then this other guy, Paul Murgatroyd, who is a lecturer down in Lincoln, who does a lot of ultra stuff and has done a lot of thinking about it, he got in touch with me as well. And so I thought it'd be helpful to share those things, because I'm sure this is something that most of us face. I'd be surprised if there's many people who get into ultra running who don't ever get sore quads, particularly if you come from a road running background where you're not used to running downhill a lot. I'm sure people who are more used to hill running and don't have as much problems, because they're probably used to running down a hill and it's just a case of running further for them, so they've got other things that they need to work on. But I thought for this podcast I'd read out some of the things which I've been given, and the article particularly that William sent me, and then just share some thoughts for myself of how I try to put those into practice and what I've done, and answer some of the questions that Ian has posed there, particularly about plans of coming off Connick Hill and my training sessions and how I try to deal with those. Again, like all things, take from this what you can. Your experience may be very different, but hopefully there's something in there that you'll be able to take off. But this is, I'll just read first of all just a couple of things from William Sitchell and Paul Murgatroyd. When I got in touch with William, this is what he said. This is what he sent me. You sound a bit like myself some years ago, in that quads pain limits your performance. In my case, it used to, but doesn't now. I attach an article written by my coach, David Murray. It was written for ski coaches, but the principles are the same. And I'll read that out in a minute. Because the length of time involved with ultras, soreness is becoming evident during the event, whereas with other distances, it would only be noticeable afterwards. Even running on the flat involves small eccentric contractions, nowhere near as much as running downhill, but after many hours of 100k or a 24-hour race, you certainly get the quad pain. Whatever the mechanism, the result is painful quads, and we want to know how to prevent it. I almost fully agree with the post on the West Highland Way website by Andrew Du Bois, to reduce quads pain in ultras, do downhill running with care. Strength train the quads, and I would add the weight vest training. I admit that I'm biased as I now sell my own design, but that wasn't the case when I first started with one in 1995. I have found that using a weight vest in long runs and hill work up and down has made a dramatic difference for me. You must gradually build up the weight. I also agree not to use ibuprofen if possible. Better to specifically strengthen the quads, no shortcuts. Also, my comments on compression clothing, leggings in particular. I believe they help and have worn them in all races and training for the past 2 years. They are very versatile and can be worn in very hot weather as long as they can be kept fairly damp. I wore white ones for the Badwater race, as well as cold conditions. They save a lot of messing about, time wasting at aid stations, as fewer clothes changes are needed. If very cold, you can easily slip a thick pair of tights on top of them. And then the second response was from, I say, Paul Murgatroyd, who's a lecturer at University in Lincoln in England, and is currently doing research on the effects of running multi-stage ultra races. And Paul sent this email in response to my answers to a number of the questions Paul asked me about my running and training for the two ultras I ran last year. What you are feeling on the long ultras was the effect of the continuous pounding and repeated eccentric contractions on the leg musculature, primarily the quads, as these suffer the most on the downhill stretches. The localized fatigue you are experiencing is similar to what you referred to as DOMS, although this is, as has been pointing out on your forum, traditionally experienced post-exercise, and the likelihood is that the causes for both would be similar. The actual physiological processes occurring in the quads and other key muscles during up and downhill running over long distances is still not fully understood, but it is likely that the discomfort felt is a combination of a number of factors. It is probable that the sensation of localized pain is brought on by the breakdown of the microfilaments of the muscle tissue through repeated eccentric stress, along with disruption to cell membranes and the possibility of cell leakage with minerals such as potassium and sodium used in muscular contraction being lost from the cell and an ionic imbalance being created. Degradation of proteins will possibly occur in the muscle as the body switches from carbohydrates and fats as fuel to amino acids during long endurance exercise. Refueling on long races is key to helping minimize this aspect of fatigue. How to offset this? Well, it looks like your break in training from injury didn't help, as typically the body will be conditioned against such stress by a large body of training miles. Suggestions of regular 60 plus miles a week up to around 100 miles a week. Certainly your program this year of heavier mileage seems to be paying dividends from your perception of improved fitness at this stage. Also, I would suggest that as many of those training miles need to be in the hills to condition the body to repeated eccentric contractions and to encourage use of the stabilizing muscles as much as possible on uneven off-road conditions. When I was training for the MDS last year, I tried to get off-road and into the hills as much as possible in order to protect the soft tissue from this kind of fatigue, and it certainly helped in the long run. Finally, a few shorter hill off-road races to condition the body to downhill running prior to the longer ultras would help both physically and mentally. So there was a couple of responses, saying very similar things really, the importance of training and working on that. What I'll do now is I'll read out the article that William sent me. This was a presentation given to professional ski instructors in 2006 by David W. Murray, ISIA. And I think basically what was skiers particularly, a lot of people going on holiday, the first day they're fine, they enjoy the skiing, but it's the second and third day that their legs are really sore. And so this was a paper given to ski instructors to try and help them prepare people to be able to enjoy their skiing holiday. But as William said in his email, the principles are the same whether you're skiing or running. So here it is, Delayed Onset Muscle Soreness by David W. Murray. Many a skiing holiday has been ruined by the fact that, after the first morning on skis, muscles unused to such strenuous activity become stiff and sore, and the soreness usually lasts a full week, which unfortunately happens to be the length of the average ski holiday. Robert Mead, writing in European Ski Resorts back in 1985. The nature of snow sports holidays and of skiers and boarders regularly results in complaints of muscle stiffness and soreness, particularly with beginners or learners. Any unaccustomed exercise usually results in muscle soreness. Calf and quadriceps muscle groups are particular areas that nervous skiers can find overused, and the limited flex and stiffness of ski boots can exacerbate the problem. Leaving aside pain due to injury, some post-exercise muscle soreness can still last for several days. Sore and stiff muscles may not be any less elastic than unstiff muscles, but the associated tenderness tends to cause the skier to modify his or her movements as a consequence of discomfort. It is known that activities involving a large degree of eccentric muscular contractions in yielding or braking movements, example defensive skiing, steep, snow ploughing, cause the most severe muscle soreness because of the way that muscle fibres must attempt to shorten whilst being extended. This gives greater stress to individual muscle fibres and consequently the greatest potential for soreness and damage. Eccentric muscular exercise is the most difficult for sore muscles to cope with, example walking downstairs rather than up. The key factor in the cause of muscle soreness is the level of exercise in relation to the skier's specific fitness for the exercise. Soreness is associated with changes in intensity or volume of exercise and even with changes in training surface. For example, short swings, jump turns, heavy deep snow and moguls, or quasi-isometric exercise like long side slips and long traverses. General tension caused by an intimidating pitch will add to the problem, and the introduction of significant and more than one specific change to the exercises at once can result in severe and debilitating soreness. There have been a number of theories to explain the phenomena of muscle soreness. Muscle spasms, connective tissue damage, muscle tears, build-up of chemicals and fluid pressure. Research has shown that the muscle spasm theory is unfounded and has not been able to confirm that muscle fibres are actually torn. Strenuous exercise results in large changes in the chemical composition of muscle fibres, including the build-up of metabolites, waste products, in particular lactic acid during exercise activity. This can cause rapid movements of water into the area from the blood to reduce the concentration of these chemicals. The fluid buildup puts pressure and stretch on the surrounding tissues and exciting nerve endings. Isometric activity can also limit blood flow to the exercise in muscles, creating soreness. As blood flow in recovery restores normal functioning and chemicals disperse, so the edema and consequently the soreness subsides. This takes only a matter of minutes rather than hours, and so is a cause of immediate and post-exercise discomfort, not a cause of lasting or delayed muscle soreness. Delayed onset muscle soreness, DOMS, 1 to 8 days. The muscle soreness that develops some 8 to 12 hours after exercise represents a different mechanism involving some temporary connective tissue and or muscle fibre damage and may include damage to capillaries. Damage has been shown to be more extensive in fast twitch than slow twitch fibres. All body cells are being replaced constantly and the tendon and muscle tissues are particularly susceptible to wear and tear as a consequence of repeated high intensity activity. Eventually, the cell membrane that surrounds a muscle or connective tissue fibre alters in its permeability and may rupture, allowing its contents to slowly leak into the fluid, bathing connective tissue between adjacent fibres. When a skier performs all day unaccustomed, intense exercise, this rupturing may occur on a massive local scale. The clearing of the debris and chemicals spilled into surrounding connective tissue is done by the body's autoimmune system. This process is known as rhabdomyolysis. With chemicals and debris leaking out of the tendon muscle cells, stimulating pain receptors, water is gradually attracted to the affected area in the same way as described for short-term muscle soreness. White blood cells then invade the damaged cells, consuming them from inside. This process continues until the job is complete, approximately 24 to 96 hours, and in acute cases peaking at 48 to 52 hours. Associated with the white cell invasion is tissue inflammation, swelling lasting up to 10 days, and consequently soreness. The soreness tends to get worse until the peak is passed. The prolonged nature of these symptoms indicates that repair to damaged soft tissues is a slow process, and concentric and isometric strength loss continues to be evident even after protective pain and tenderness have disappeared, lasting up to 11 days. Slight muscle tendon tenderness that develops following exercise and perhaps persisting the day after is an indicator of the relatively hard specific nature of the training exercise done. This low degree of soreness is not a problem, providing one bears it in mind that the relevant muscle is now ripe for injury, and so caution is the watchword for both the day's warm-up exercise and skiing program. However, the progressive ache, tenderness and stiffness associated with acute rhabdomyolysis developing slowly some hours after exercise is a serious problem which will take approximately 6 days to recover from. Limiting exercise intensity and skill for at least a week, a properly executed warm down, including gentle but prolonged static stretching, will reduce the risk of minor muscle stiffness, but may exacerbate the problem of muscle damage in DOMS. Adding real warmth as opposed to heat creams, which mainly override pain signals, will offer temporary relief to pain by reducing pressure and the internal friction of the tissues. However, when the tissues cool, the soreness will probably return and could have been made worse, particularly with calf soreness, if the rhabdomyolysis repair process is acute. Stretching routines will have a similar temporary improvement, but the possibility of prolonging and actually making the situation worse further via cause more micro trauma. Warming in the form of mild sauna or 20 minutes bathing in water of approximately 40 degrees centigrade and stretching is more beneficial after the peak inflammation has passed on the third post-training day. Exercise-induced muscle warmth and blood flow has a similar effect, where too much or too intense exercise will aggravate the problem, soreness returning with a vengeance. During the first three post-training days, only non-weight-bearing exercise is recommended to promote removal of excess fluid. Properly executed sports massage therapy will also be beneficial at this stage. Initial treatment for muscle soreness should follow the usual advice for injuries. Protect, rest, ice, compression and elevation are what are required. If muscle soreness is anticipated, intermediate cold application in 10-minute bouts is most effective in reducing its development as well as treating severe soreness. Note, if soreness persists for more than 10 days or is recurrent, there may be a more serious problem requiring further medical attention. Okay, so that was the article that David Murray had written and that William Sitchell recommended I read. I must admit, a lot of that probably went right over my head and it may go over your head. But the thing that I really took from that was that when you're running downhill, your muscles are contracting, but they're also the lengthening. And it's that pounding as your muscles contract, as they lengthen as you're running downhill, that what causes the problems. And I would say in my first year, like most people, I probably ran down Connick Hill a bit too quick. That process probably started, and then I was fine for the next 12 hours. But by the time I got to 16 hours at King's House, the DOMS had come on and my quads were so sore that I couldn't run downhill and even struggled to walk downhill. So I decided, what could I do to try and improve and try and deal with it? And William Sitchell gave me some ideas about the importance of doing more specific training downhill. So I would say there's three main things that I did after that first year that worked for me. One was I put a pair of skins. William mentioned in his article that he wears them all the time and you see lots of runners running with them. And they, I don't know, there's no great evidence, I suppose, that says they make all the difference, but certainly they helped. For me, I bought the half ones. I love running with shorts on, and I didn't really want to wear full-length ones. So I got the half ones, which basically it was the quads that I wanted to try and help. And I've worn them ever since. Must be in like the fifth year now. Any run over 2 hours or around about 2 hours and above, I'll wear them. And I find they're great. They're really comfortable. If they help me, then that's great. That's a bonus. But I think they are, so they probably are doing some good. So I bought a pair of skins and I used them for all my long runs. And I say they seem to, hopefully they helped my quads. The second thing I did was to do a lot more downhill running. And for me, what I would do is when I do my regular runs up on the Braes, in fact, I was up there this morning for a couple of hours, and I'll just try and make sure when there is little downhill bits to work on that. And this might sound a bit silly, but I remember that first year, as I ran down, I would talk to my muscles and I would say, right, come on, guys, you're contracting now as you lengthen and you need to get used to this. And I'd try and sort of talk myself into getting those muscles ready. That was just me, but that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to try and run those. So whenever there was a downhill run, I would try and really concentrate on my downhill running, try not to break so that I would lean forward, take short strides. I'm not the best downhill runner at all, but I've really tried to sort of work on that as much as I can. Even last Sunday running with Dave in the lakes, I was following him down a long section and it was really interesting the way he ran, just short steps and just bounced his way down. And I'm trying to do that more and more because I think, you know, for me, if I break too much and lean back, I'm going to put more stress on my quads and therefore they're going to get more sore. So I would try hard. And particularly when I was I'd go on the West Highland Way once a month and do a long run. And I would try and make sure that when there was a long downhill section, again, I really concentrated on that and thought, this is not just the time to relax. This is the time to really get your quads ready and train them better. So I did that. And then the third thing I did was took William's advice by running with a weighted rucksack. Now, I must admit, I didn't buy one of William's patented rucksacks. I just used my ordinary rucksack and I'd put a book in. And the first time I put it on the blog, actually, I remember people saying, does it depend what type of book it is? But for me, it was just a kid's book. It was a hard A4 size, hardback. And the first time I just put one, and then the next month, I'd sort of increase it so it got a bit heavier. And even this year, I'm training for the Lakeland 100 race this year, and I've been running with a rucksack on all my long runs with more gear in, because we have to run without a weighted foot, you know, with a certain amount of kit for the Lakeland race. And I'm finding that's helping as well on the training runs, because William's thought is that if you go on a 3-hour run with no rucksack, you're not going to get into the stage where the muscles are under pressure. Whereas if you go for a 3-hour run with a weighted rucksack, that's giving the equivalent of maybe a 5-6 hour run. That's the sort of theory. But I certainly did that second year, and it helped. I don't know which of those was the most important for me. I think one of the things was, I think it does take a while for your body to get used to running these distances. I've been running ultras now, this is my sixth year, and I found that I've not had any problems with DOMS, with my quads this year. I put on my blog this week after the Lakeland race, I don't know whether it's because I'm running a little bit slower this year because the way I've been going with running with Katrina and then running with the in the lakes where we've been doing the recce and the routes and taking our time and stopping frequently to work out the route, or whether it's I'm a bit fitter this year. Whether the Hokas that I've been wearing over the last three runs, whether they've made a significant difference, I'm not sure. Tim Downey got in touch with me on. He said that he's found the same this year, that he's not had much problems with DOMS and with muscles with quads. And we've both been running ultras around about the same time. He started a year or so ahead of me. But I wonder whether it takes 4 to 5, 6 years. I don't know. Maybe that's not a great thing to say if you're just starting out. But I would say the second year I didn't have anywhere near the same problems, and I haven't really had the same sort of problems I had the first year from then on. So maybe it takes a year or so of constantly running once a month and lots of long downhill running to get to the point where you are able to run better downhill. It'd be interesting what others thought about that. So when Ian asked in his email, do you put your success in 2008 down to running more? I would say yes. I think I ran more generally. I increased my mileage from 40 miles a week to nearer 55, 60 miles a week. I had a rest week in once a month, so I built that in as well. Certainly worked harder on the downhill. Those downhill sessions, I would sometimes do some specific things. I'd find a hill, which was about a mile from my house in Paisley. There's about a mile to the bottom of a big steep hill up to Robinson's car park, and then I'd run up and go a bit further, and then I'd run all the way down. So it was a good mile and a bit of quite steep downhill running, and I think, you know, I would try and do that a couple of times a month and really build up. I say when I got onto the hills, the long runs, I concentrated on the downhill running. So I think that was a key thing. there were the Pacific sessions. Try the weighted rucksack if that's something that you've had a problem with. Your quads, I would try and run with a weighted rucksack, and it does help, and it just puts your quads under more pressure, which means they're going to adapt quicker to be able to do the race. He also asked, do you think it's wise to run hard off Connick early on or take it easy? Without doubt, I would say take it easy, personally. Again, everyone's different, but that first year was a big learning curve for me. And in the next 2 years, when I broke 20 hours, I would say with the group of people I was running with, I was the slowest coming off Connick Hill. I remember one of the races, there was a group of us, maybe I'd gone past a couple of them on the way up the hill, up Connick, but on the way down, they just left me for dead. And maybe they took 5, even 10 minutes out of me from the top of Connick Hill down to Balmaha, which is only a mile and a bit. And they were 5 minutes ahead of me. But what I found really interesting was when you look at the results of people, some of those guys that went past me and took 5, 10 minutes out of me, I beat them overall by an hour, 2 hours. Now, again, that's not the be-all and end-all, but it was interesting that I would say you can be 10 minutes slower to Balmaha and yet save yourself 2 or 3 hours later on in the race. And that's certainly been my experience. That if you hammer off Connick Hill thinking, oh great, a downhill bit, I can really push the pace now, and you push too hard, you'll be fine for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 miles, but it will be payback when you get to 70 miles. And so yeah, my experience, my advice would certainly be to take it really easy off Connick Hill. I just personally don't see the advantage in being 5 minutes quicker to Balmaha and then trashing my quads for the later part of the race. And also, I think if you can avoid having sore quads, the race is so much more enjoyable. In 08 and 09, I remember catching people over that last 20 miles when they were starting to really struggle with their quads and it was sore. And it reminded me of the year before and the difference when because I was still running and still feeling okay. I know what I would rather do. So certainly my advice would be to take it easy off Connick and be really careful. So I think from what I've said so far, it is a big issue. And I think most of us suffer from sore quads, particularly those who come from a road running background. And it may be that there are no shortcuts to this. It may be that you just need to do it for 2 or 3 years to build up your legs, just be strong enough to be able to run the downhills. But I think there are things you can do. And if my advice would be, if this is your first race this year, the race is, 10 weeks away. You've got plenty of time to train those quads. If you're aware that some of the long runs you've done, you've finished with sore quads. If you do the fling race, which is in 3 weeks tomorrow, and your quads are sore like mine were the first year, you've got time. There's 7 weeks between the fling and the West Harlem Way race. If you can try and do some downhill running, run with a weighted rucksack when you do some 2-3 hour runs between now and the race, all those things are going to help. And also, I would just be really cautious over the first 20, 30 miles of the West Harlem Way. Any hills, don't hammer them on the way down, particularly off Connick Hill. And try and save your quads for the last 20, 30 miles because, as I said, it will be a lot more enjoyable. I hope that's been helpful to somebody. If you've got any comments, then please use the forum, use Facebook to reply. And to share your own experiences as well of how you've coped with muscle soreness, particularly in the quads, because it is a big issue. Well, I hope that's answered some of Ian's questions, and hopefully that's answered others as well, and can be a source of help to some. Lessons I've learned from the West Harlem Way, number 11. This one is thinking about on the run. One of the things I found really helpful to do is to have a little bit of an MOT, a bit of a checklist through the race. I think the first time I did this was maybe just after Rowa Denon, so I'd done about sort of 28, 29 miles heading up that long hill out of Rowadennan, and just started to give myself a little bit of a mental MOT just to see how I was getting on. And it's something I've done quite regularly in long races ever since. And I know, again, talking to people, other people do this as well. I was chatting to my friend Dave, who says that he works from the feet upwards. I must admit, I always go from the head down. So basically, as I'm walking along, I just give myself a little MOT, thinking about how I'm getting on so far and work my way through the body. So I'll start with my head and I'll think, right, am I still pretty positive about the race? Am I feeling okay? I'm still focusing on what I'm trying to do, trying to keep with my pace that I'm running at, trying to make sure I'm not getting too ahead of myself, just running to the next mini checkpoint or the next checkpoint, and making sure my head's in the right place and I'm not getting too discouraged or down on myself. And then I'll work my way down my body, thinking about my shoulders. Do they feel relaxed? If I'm wearing a rucksack, making sure that it's comfortable and I'm not tense in my shoulders. Working down into my arms, again, trying to keep a low arms, just give my an MOT check, just to make sure I'm not gripping too hard and wasting energy with my hands, and trying to run nice and smooth and relaxed. Thinking about my stomach, spend a bit of time just making sure I've been drinking enough, making sure I'm eating okay. Am I taking on board the calories that I need, that I'd planned for the different sections? Thinking as well about if I've got a waistband on, is it, make sure it's not too tight so it's not squashing me around my stomach, or it's not too loose that it's bouncing around. So again, just a little MOT on my stomach to make sure that I've eaten and drank enough, making sure I've been taking my salt tablets every 90 minutes or so, whatever I've planned, depending on the weather. So feeling good. Then working my way down to my groin and my quads. My groins have been okay after the first year or two. I used to get really sore, but then when I started wearing the skins particularly, I've not had a problem there, but just checking out that that's all right. My quads, that's a key thing for distance running, ultra running, is making sure your quads are okay. And just checking that on the downhills, particularly for me, down into Balmahar, I don't push too hard and thrash my quads, which will come back to haunt me later on. So just thinking about the little bits of hills that I've got, that I'm nice and relaxed and trying to lean forward and just run down the hill with a bit of gravity rather than braking and leaning back. Down to my calves. Again, are my calves okay? Making sure that they're just feeling nice and relaxed, that I'm not putting too much pressure on them. So that's the next bit. And then down to my feet, making sure there's no hot spots, no blisters forming, making sure I'm trying to land on my midsole rather than my heel, and just thinking about my running style and making sure that's nice and relaxed. When I've got a walk up the hills, making sure I'm just striding out and I'm getting a good pace going, but trying to run as much as I can on the flat and the downhills. So that would take me probably 5 or 10 minutes on the race day, just spending time working my way through. And at the end of that, sometimes it makes me feel better just to know that, yep, you're on track. Obviously, if you've been running for maybe 30 miles by then, you're bound to be tired, but making sure that there's plenty in reserve and you've still got plenty left. So that's one of the lessons I've learned from the West Highland Way, just the importance of doing a little MOT. And I would do that probably, I'd say, after Rowadennan, and then I'd probably do it again maybe after Bridge of Orkney, and then again after Kinlochleven, if I can remember. So it's just giving those little MOTs along the way just to make sure I'm not forgetting anything silly, and I'm on top of all my food and running style and on feeling good. So that's my lesson from the West Highland Way. The importance of doing a little MOT, a little checkpoints along the way just to check everything's going well. From A to the B, cross an ocean, cross a sea, 'cause I think I like you, I think I do. You can't deny, I deserve it if you try, 'cause I think I like you, I think I do. I hope you've enjoyed the West Highland Way podcast number 13. The race is just over about 10 weeks away now, so it's getting closer by the week. And I hope your training's going well. I hope you're feeling fit and strong, and you're looking forward to being on that start line in a few months' time. So bye for now, and remember, slow and steady wins the race.